look at the house, slate blue in the dusky shadows, and I'm glad that it's resting, nestled in a circle of overgrown shrubs. Midway through its third century, God knows what it's had to contain.
Welcome, all, to the 12th episode of Rice Pudding Poetry, a project of Rice Public Library on Wentworth Street in Kittery, Maine. This is a show we're sending out to all of you in the dead of winter, an old expression that began as the phrase dead of night in Shakespeare's Twelfth Night. We hear it first in the words of Viola, who, dressed as the suitor Cesario, says to the beloved Olivia, "Make me a willow cabin at your gate, and call upon my soul within the house. Write loyal cantons of condemned love, and sing them loud, even in the dead of night." Our featured poet, Suzanne Simmons, you heard her voice at the top of the show, has given us the theme of inside, a word that evokes images of interiority and containment, yes, even as it implies its opposite, outside, as well as the threshold spaces or gates between the two. I'm your host, Kimberly Green, and we hope the poetry and music you hear on our show offer a little quiet time and space for rest and reflection, perhaps even for remembering. The cold and dark of winter seem to invite these. That was In the Bleak Midwinter, originally a poem by Christina Rossetti and later paired with a tune by Gustav Holst. All the music you'll hear on our show is performed by Jonathan Booth. More about him and Suzanne, of course, in a moment. We're grateful also to welcome our community readers Tim Kingsbury, Melissa Paley, Steve Hagen, and Mara Lamstein, whose poem selections engage Suzanne's theme of inside in various and surprising ways. Many of you know that Charles Simic, prolific poet, translator, critic, and essayist, former U.S. Poet Laureate, and cherished friend to many in our community, died just a couple of weeks ago on January 9th. We'll miss him very much. Here's his beloved poem, Stone, an inside poem, if ever there was one. Stone by Charles Simic. Go inside a stone, that would be my way. Let somebody else become a dove, or gnash with a tiger's tooth. I am happy to be a stone. From the outside, the stone is a riddle. No one knows how to answer it. Yet within, it must be cool and quiet, even though a cow steps on it full weight. even though a child throws it in a river. The stone sinks slow, unperturbed, to the river bottom, where the fishes come to knock on it and listen. I have seen sparks fly out when two stones are rubbed. So perhaps it is not dark inside, after all. Perhaps there is a moon shining from somewhere, as though behind a hill. Just enough light to make out the strange writings, the star charts on the inner walls. You just heard Jonathan Booth's Soft Shell. We're so glad to have John on this show. John earned his degree in music composition at Berklee College of Music in Boston and went on to perform in a variety of bands throughout New England and the Northeast. He's been enjoying a renewed focus on songwriting and composing, and he performs occasionally with Main Squeeze, The Rushmores, Maggie's Farm Stand, and others in the Seacoast area. All of the music on this show, except in the bleak midwinter, is original. Now let's bring in our featured poet, Suzanne Simmons, who is a poet, prose writer, and photographer. Her work has been published in the New York Times, Fifth Wednesday, Rattle, Smartish Pace, the Baltimore Review, and other journals. A Pushcart Prize nominee, Suzanne has a chapbook called In September They Draw Down the Lake, which was published by Alexandria Quarterly Press in 2020. She lives in Elliott, Maine, and has volunteered with organizations such as Monarch Watch, the Center for Wildlife, and Hospice. Suzanne is sharing both her poetry and some of her prose on this show. Here is Suzanne Simmons.
Hello, my name is Suzanne Simmons. I'm from Elliott, Maine, and I'm very grateful to be here reading as part of the Rice Pudding Poetry Series. It's January, and though the days are getting longer, it's pretty hard to tell just yet. We're still in the time of drawing inward, close to the hearth, a time of long nights and introspection, so I chose inside as the theme for tonight's reading. Of course, inside implies an outside and some kind of boundary or threshold between them. And that's where things get interesting. The thousands of small journeys we take between one state and another. I thought about the many things in the world that seem to hold or contain us for a while, whether they're houses, relationships, enclosed spaces we share with travelers, night skies that seem to wrap around us, or even time itself. So here are a few poems scratching at the door. The first one is called Kayak with Loon. Suppose we cross the lake together in half moonlight. We'll be black shapes floating between water and sky, between darkness and its shadow. Suppose when you cry, my chest vibrates with the sound. This is why I'm here, Loon, because I cannot wail as you do, with your throat open and full of night. Suppose your cry is a tunnel that carries us so far back in time, the houses on the shore dissolve. All of the cellar holes brim. When you call, the horned owl answers, a gurgling screech that ends in a wheeze, and one by one, the stars fall down. You wail again, Loon, and we drift through the notes and their absence. Stay with me as I dabble in black water, swallow stones to grind in my gut, liquefy my bones, become echo. Commute. The train is half full, 2 seats per rider. Does that explain this hush? We're all going to the same place. It's called Haverhill or Exeter or Durham. We slide away from bridges and warehouses into thawing woods, gray limbs against a coral sky. No one speaks. The train is rocking and chanting, New Hampshire, New Hampshire, New Hampshire. We lean our heads on the cold windows. Snow sinks into the earth. One among us can't bear it. He enters the hinged capsule between cars and flips open his phone. We watch his lips plead, Hello? New Hampshire, New Hampshire, New Hampshire. The conductor is passing. He says, Dover, follow me. Dover. His voice is firm. Some rise and follow. Outside, the spaces between things darken to ash. A yellow moon ascends. For a time, an abandoned track runs parallel to ours. The train streaking beside us blows its whistle years ago. We are almost there. This next poem is a lullaby I wrote for the feral ghost children who appear in Marilyn Robinson's first novel, Housekeeping. I'd like to read a brief passage from the book. I knew why Sylvie felt there were children in the woods. I felt so too, though I did not think so. I sat on the log, pelting my shoe, because I knew that if I turned, however quickly, to look behind me, the consciousness behind me would not still be there, and would only come closer when I turned away again. Even if it spoke just at my ear, as it seemed often at the point of doing, when I turned, there would be nothing there. In that way, it was persistent and teasing and ungentle, the way half-wild, lonely children are. Lullaby. Where did you fall in love with the world? With which ribbon of grass? Which furred humming bee? How long did you stare into Toad's golden eye, while grown-ups floated heavy and slow, like the boats on the river that slid off the earth? When did you fall in the bittersweet bitter clover and chives and smell of warm dirt? What did you love? What captured your fall? Minnow and dew and hard seckle pears, spicy sweet juice that flooded your tongue. You followed it down like swallow wings dipping, weaving through sighs and train's lullaby. You dreamed in sound, breathed in sky. And where did you fall? How far down? How far gone? How deep in the earth have you buried your song? Both of my parents left this world via hospice, and I was struck by how time seemed to take on a different quality during those days. It didn't seem slower or faster, but more like another entity in the room with us. My father was a fighter pilot in World War II, and I wrote this poem for him a few days after he died. One of the hospice nurses asked me at one point who was coming for him, and I misunderstood her. I thought perhaps she was asking if someone was coming to pick him up. What she meant was, who is coming for him from the other side? Hospice. Who's coming for him? The nurse asked. And in my confusion, I thought the gulls were angels rising and falling through the fog. Or they could have been fighter planes from an old movie reel. Flyboy, I swear the moon stopped climbing. Sat like a whole note between the power lines. 1, 2, 3, 4. I counted seconds between your breasts. The strength of your heartbeat still shook the bed. Later, pulling into the driveway, my headlights caught Possum slipping behind the shed, his long pink tail curling into shadow. Then the moon rose. No one needed to tell her. Everywhere she looked, other trees, other apples. The snake was glib, but not compelling. She knew that she was naked by the way the grass clung to her feet, by the wash of sun behind her eyelids, the branches abrading her skin. Everything penetrated. The apple waited, collected a crescent of light on one curve, hid its deepest hues in a pocket of leaves. The branch fought her when she twisted the stem, then the weight in her palm. Because she was naked, she arched her neck, bared her teeth, punctured the fragrant skin, the dividing line. Of course she turned to the other, offered the fruit, whispered, "Love, we are naked. Falling. Come." Around 10 years ago, I discovered that the first house I'd ever lived in was empty and gradually being reclaimed by the landscape around it. I spent 7 years photographing its decline, and that was my excuse for visiting the property. But the truth is I became obsessed, or enchanted, or maybe a little of both. Often when I was driving there, I would tell myself that it would be the last time, but I always fell under the spell of the place. I've been working on a memoir about the house and what I learned from it, and this is the prologue. Some facts about the northern mockingbird. Mockingbirds are known for singing and imitating other birds and sounds, and their songs change with the seasons. Female mockingbirds sing more quietly than males, and rarely in the summer. Mockingbirds can recall individual humans who have come near their nests. I know a mockingbird. I call him Dad. The mockingbird who is my father lives in a tangle of bittersweet over the rusted remains of a gate in a sagging chain-link fence. A few feet away from the gate, several slabs of lichen-colored granite cover the site of an old well. I like to sit on the granite and listen to my father sing. I have to trespass on someone else's property to do this. The owner's name is R.H. III, but I knew him as a freckled boy called Skip when I was a girl. He owns this place, but lives in finer houses. He'll no longer answer my emails, and I don't have his permission to be here. But I've been coming for years, to write and to wander, and to press my face and the lens of my camera up against the windows of the disintegrating house. I peer in, entranced by the light that bends itself around the doorways and corners of the silent rooms. I have reasons for spending my days haunting the empty house I once lived in as a child. I go there to take photographs. It's a project I'm working on. I go there to write. I'm writing a book. I go there because I'm the steward. What would happen to it without me? I go because my dog Tippy is buried behind the barn. I go because the three sisters, two sugar maples and an elm in the front yard, have doubled in size while I have shrunk. I'm still a child walking beneath them, and they dote on me. The boot scraper on the granite slab by the front door is listed in my internal registry of significant places. Trains pass through the hilly fields behind the house, usually the sleek downeaster carrying passengers between Portland and Boston. Occasionally, a freight train still comes through without a caboose or a caboose man to scatter pennies in the field. I go because my body thrums like a tuning fork on this small patch of land, this arrangement of bees and clover and hickory trees and train tracks and river gleam and emptiness. I can't stop going. The house sits on a hill in New Hampshire, overlooking a river and the town in the distance. Built in 1763 by Ebenezer Swayze, it was until very recently part of a large estate, encompassing fields and stone walls and woods along the Squamscott River. The big house was sold recently, a pillared building that seemed like a mansion to me as a child. Nell Swayze's house, separated from ours by a fence and a gate that never opened, was torn down after she died. I was 6 then, terrified of Nell alive, hunched and muttering among her blood-red poppies, and terrified of Nell dead, vanished. Once I peeked in the windows after she died and saw her yellow fly swatter hanging next to the apron she wore in the garden, and then I ran and ran until I reached the creek and the chill water around my ankles quieted my pounding heart. And then her house was gone. This is what happens when you die. First, you disappear, then your house. This was one of my childhood beliefs. Along with, if you're outside and you don't climb onto the swing set before the train blows its whistle, you will die. If the power lines break, everyone will die. Sparrows and jays are bad birds. Swallows are good. Tippy was not really dead when we buried him, even though he got hit by the train. I saw him breathe when we put him in the ground. When Dad has a layover and has to sleep in the doghouse at the airport, the doghouse looks like Nana's in my Peter Pan book, and Dad's feet in their pajamas stick out of it. Eating bread crusts will make your hair curly. The barn is the best place, or the creek, or the narrow alley behind the sofa. I look at the house, slate blue in the dusky shadows, and I'm glad that it's resting, nestled in a circle of overgrown shrubs. Midway through its third century, God knows what it's had to contain. I climb into my van, roll the window down, and yell toward Nell's gate, "Bye, Dad." The mockingbird cocks his head at me from his perch, but doesn't stop his singing. This time of day, he gets a bit operatic. I shift into drive and head back to the living.
Thank you for your lovely presence and beautiful writing, Suzanne. And thank you, John, for your Lydian and In the Neighborhood. Suzanne's book, In September They Draw Down the Lake, may be purchased most anywhere, but I'll encourage you to buy it from her directly at www.suzannesimmons.net. Our community readers, Tim Kingsbury, Melissa Paley, Steve Hagen, and Mara Lamstein, have brought us poems inspired by Suzanne's theme of inside, though location, as well as view, insight, and meaning, will shift as we listen. The readers themselves will offer a bit more about the work they've chosen. Let's listen.
Hello, my name is Tim Kingsbury, and I live in Elliott, Maine. As a community reader, I've selected a poem by Stuart Kestenbaum. The title is, Within, We Are All Full of Light, which I think supports the theme of inside, chosen by our featured poet today, Suzanne Simmons. Stewart is the former Poet Laureate of Maine from 2016 to 2021, the author of 6 collections of poems. The poem is from Only Now, a Deerbrook edition 2014. I was attracted to this poem due to Stewart's use of physics, of light, revealed in the phenomenon of the camera obscura. Within, we are all full of light. Imagine the wonderment of the people who built the first camera obscura and discovered that a stream of light can tell us so much. How one tiny hole in the wall can let in the wavelengths that draw a perfect picture. It's upside down, which shakes us up, but shows us that something is watching us too. Inscribing each detail, steeple and leaf, hill and cloud, making every color possible. And this morning, when I go outside and stare into the spring light, being absorbed and bounced off the gray stone walk and new dandelions, I become my own darkened room, letting the day in to write its history on the back wall of my mind. Light within, light without, I close my eyes to see what I have loved.
My name is Melissa Paley, and I live in Kittery Point. I'm going to read a poem called Birches by Robert Frost that was written in 1915. I love this poem because of the way that he evokes this scene in the woods and how the trees themselves are sort of an arc to his life, both younger and older. When I see birches bend to left and right across the lines of straighter, darker trees, I like to think some boy's been swinging them. But swinging doesn't bend them down to stay as ice storms do. Often, you must have seen them loaded with ice a sunny winter morning after a rain. They click upon themselves as the breeze rises and turn many colored as the stir cracks and crazes their enamel. Soon the sun's warmth makes them shed crystal shells, shattering and avalanching on the snow crust, such heaps of broken glass to sweep away, you'd think the inner dome of heaven had fallen. They are dragged to the withered bracken by the load, and they seem not to break, though once they are bowed so low for long, they never right themselves. You may see their trunks arching in the woods years afterwards, trailing their leaves on the ground like girls on hands and knees that throw their hair before them over their heads to dry in the sun. But I was going to say, when truth broke in with all her matter of fact about the ice storm, I should prefer to have some boy bend them as he went out and in to fetch the cows. Some boy too far from town to learn baseball, whose only play was what he found himself, summer or winter, and could play alone. One by one, he subdued his father's trees by riding them down over and over again until he took the stiffness out of them, and not one but hung limp, not one was left for him to conquer. He learned all there was to learn about not launching out too soon, and so not carrying the tree away clear to the ground. He always kept his poise to the top branches, climbing carefully with the same pains you use to fill a cup up to the brim, and even above the brim. Then he flung outward, feet first, with a swish, kicking his way down through the air to the ground. So was I, once myself, a swinger of birches. And so I dream of going back to be. It's when I'm weary of considerations and life is too much like a pathless wood where your face burns and tickles with the cobwebs broken across it, and one eye is weeping from a twig's having lashed across it open. I'd like to get away from Earth a while, and then come back to it and begin over. May no fate willfully misunderstand me and half grant what I wish and snatch me away not to return. Earth's the right place for love. I don't know where it's likely to go better. I'd like to go by climbing a birch tree and climb black branches up a snow-white trunk toward heaven, till the tree could bear no more, but dipped its top and set me down again. That would be good, both going and coming back. One could do worse than be a swinger of birches.
Hi, I'm Steve Hagen, and I am delighted to be a community reader in a small part of Rice Pudding, sharing a poem on this very cold winter day. I'm from Madbury, New Hampshire. I've lived in this area for about 25 years now, having moved from Virginia, where the winters are short and hardly winters at all, really. Over those years, I've adjusted, I think, progressing from really disliking long periods of darkness to accepting them and now embracing the quiet cold. I think some of my embrace of winter comes from getting better at finding ways to be outside. And a lot of it comes from building relationships and community here in New Hampshire and in Maine that sustain me during the darkness. So today I'm happy to be sharing a Carl Sandburg poem. Sandburg was born 100 years before I was, in the 1870s. As a young man in Wisconsin, he drove a milk wagon, he worked as a porter in a hotel, as a bricklayer, and a farm laborer before he began a writing career as a journalist. And then over the following few decades, he became one of the most celebrated writers of his time, winning 3 Pulitzer Prizes. And the poem I share is titled At a Window. A window can transform the experience of being inside in the physical world, I think, as well as in a metaphorical level. Inside really only makes sense in the context of an outside. For me, my inside life, my internal understanding of myself is really only defined by my relationships with humans and the more than human world outside of me. And I'm sustained by those relationships. And I think I can endure a lot, including a long dark winter, if I have these connections, or even really just the promise of these connections. And so here's At a Window by Carl Sandburg. Give me hunger, O you gods that sit and give the world its orders. Give me hunger, pain, and want. Shut me out with shame and failure from your doors of gold and fame. Give me your shabbiest, weariest hunger. But leave me a little love, a voice to speak to me in the dark end, a hand to touch me in the dark room, breaking the long loneliness. In the dusk of day shapes, blurring the sunset, one little wandering western star thrust out from the changing shores of shadow. Let me go to the window, watch there the day shapes of dusk, and wait, and know the coming of a little love. Thank you.
My name is Mara Lamstein, and I live in Kittery, Maine. The poem I am reading, Glass Night, by Wes McNair, appears in his collection, Talking in the Dark. His newest collection of poems is called Late Wonders, and both collections are published by Godin. For me, this poem conjures up the image of moving through the darkness of winter while being held in the comfort of a warm car along a familiar road. It holds both the darkness and the promise of light, which for me is almost like a prayer, allowing us to go deeper into winter's darkness while offering glimmers of light that provides hope and comfort along the way. Glass Night by Wes McNair. Come warm rain and cold snap, come car light and country road winding me around dark's finger. Come flash of mailbox and sign, and shine of brush, stubble, and all the lit lonely windows wrapped in the glass branches of tree after flying tree. Come moon-coated snow hills, and flung far ahead pole by pole the long glass cobweb in my high beam that carries me deeper, come deeper, and mute dark and speech of light, come glass night.
Thank you, Tim, Melissa, Steve, and Mara, for your wonderful voicing of poems by Stuart Kestenbaum, Robert Frost, Carl Sandburg, and Wes McNair. And thank you, John, for your beautiful Brook Ice. We look forward to gathering with all of you for our next live show of Rice Pudding Poetry in the new community room at Rice Public Library this April. The show will be hosted by Shelley Gerdner and will feature New York poet Lily Greenberg, along with special guest musicians and community readers. We hope to see you there in the new green light of spring. Abundant thanks to Library Director Lee Perkins and Tech Services Supervisor Greta Evans, who are generous and enthusiastic in their support of this show. This podcast episode of Rice Pudding Poetry is engineered by Douglas Green, and our podcast art is by graphic designer Sophie Green. Our theme music is Pussy Hat, composed by Kent Allen and Joyce Anderson. I'm Kimberly Green, and I'm most grateful to you, dear listeners, near and far. Take good care, everyone, in this sometimes snowy, bright, star, showy season. Bye for now.